Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the BC. It is Saturday, the 29th day of August. I can't believe that's where
the
we
month
are
of,
in the month.
Yeah.
29th day of August, Anno Domini 2020, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 7 minutes after the hour. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. And before anybody asks, that picture of Rob Linton on the YouTube channel right now is him sitting on an airplane, not on anything else.
That he posted himself.
All right. An upcoming Windows 10 update is expected to resolve a bug affecting the optimized drives tool that could be damaging the longevity of solid-state drives, SSDs. Issues first arose with Windows 10 version 2004, pushed live in May, after which users began to report that the optimization tool was failing to record the last time a drive had been defragged. This meant Windows 10 was performing automatic drive optimization far more frequently than it should, which could have implications for the lifespan of a solid-state drive. When a drive is defragmented, its contents are reorganized in a way that allows data to be accessed more quickly. Defragging a heavily fragmented drive can result in stark performance gains, but the optimization process is also taxing for the drive itself. Traditionally, Windows 10 should record the last time a drive had been optimized to ensure it is not subjected to unnecessary wear and tear. In the case of SSDs, some experts, I'm one of them, believe it's not sensible to perform defragmentation at all, while others have previously stated that there are benefits to optimizing a heavily fragmented SSD roughly once a month. Yeah, I suppose if you did it one couple of times a year, maybe that would be okay. However, as a result of the Windows 10 2004 bug, the optimized drives tool is defragmenting drives every time the connected device is rebooted. In effect, this means many SSDs are being defragged about 30 times more frequently than is optimal. Microsoft has acknowledged the issue, first identified in June, and has already rolled out a fix for members of its Insider program. While we Windows 10 great unwashed wait for the fix to be tested in beta and rolled out to the entire user base, it is advisable to turn off automatic defragging to prevent further damage to SSDs. In most instances, Windows is able to distinguish between HDDs, hard disk drives, and SSDs, solid-state drives, and will perform a harmless trim process on the latter as opposed to a full defragmentation. However, Windows will defrag an SSD by design if volume snapshots are enabled, which allows users to roll back to a previous state via system restore. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows 10 update could be damaging your SSD. Your choices are, oh no, I'll turn it off immediately, SS what now? Windows and other. So far, we have 52 votes in the poll, and Windows is edging out, I'll turn it off immediately, followed by oh no. If you have more to say, and so many of you do, it's easy enough to do. What you do is go to our website at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you. Scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, the second link down, under Fascinating Stuff is the forums. That's the top link, and the second forum down is the poll discussion. And the number one item under poll discussion, at least currently, is 29. Maybe it isn't yet. I think I did not put it in, but I will now. 29 Aug 20, Windows 10 update could be damaging your SSD.
And the reason it damages it is the way SSDs are created. You have little cells that store a charge, and there's an insulation around each cell. And so what the drive controller does is it burns through the insulation a little bit to store the charge in the cell. So every time you write to an SSD, you're damaging it a little bit. So the more often you write, the faster it's going to wear out. And so if it's trying to defrag, you know, a dozen times a day, it's going to wear out really fast.
Yeah. And it's really not, it's not necessary.
Yeah. The modern OSs, NTFS and HFS Plus, don't let files get that fragmented in the first place.
Right. And the whole idea behind defragmentation is that on a regular hard disk drive, a spinning disk drive, mm-hmm. you've got an arm like the tone arm on a phonograph, if anybody remembers those, that moves around. And the more you have to move it around and wait for the platters to come around and everything else, the slower your system is. On an SSD, it works very similarly to random access memory.
Yeah.
So it's much faster, and defragmentation isn't nearly as necessary. So defragmenting to begin with is hardly necessary, and doing it
that
more
often
than a couple of times a year is a really bad idea if you want to have any long-lived SSD.
I had a friend that 20 years ago, we would set aside one Saturday a month defrag our hard drives. Because it took hours and hours and hours to defrag our 100 meg hard drive.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I get it. You do want to do it for a drive that is spinning, for a hard disk drive. And you certainly want to do a defrag on a hard disk drive if it's your operating system. Because that will speed up loading and everything else.
Yeah.
Of course, there are a bunch of other things you can do to speed up loading, like using Revo on installer to pare down the size of your registry and many things like that. But an SSD boots up in about 10 seconds anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know how much faster you really need it, that it's worth killing that drive prematurely.
And most people don't reboot their machine hardly ever anyway.
That's true. Well, laptops.
Yeah.
Which is where you're mostly going to find SSDs anyway.
Yep.
So yeah, you some people just close the laptop and let it run even with the lid closed. It's still using a little bit of battery.
Yeah, asleep, which is it wakes up faster than boots.
Right, and that's fair. But if you're one of those people who turns it off, then you know you're going through a defrag every time you turn it on, and that's really not a terrific idea. So don't. I don't think I can't tell you when I last defragmented.
I haven't
anything.
Yeah, not since NTFS FAT.
Right,
because it does such a better job of organizing stuff and keeping it in line.
Right.
Back in the old days with the MFM drives and RLLs.
Right.
You needed to in the old 32-bit system.
Right. The old 16-bit system and the 8-bit system.
Yeah.
You really needed it, but now it's not as big a thing. Anyway, to the phones. Our first caller is Carl from Pottstown, PA. Hiya, Carl. What's up?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Peachy, how are you?
Okay. I just want to thank you for all the help you give people. It's really valuable, so thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I have two unrelated questions, and ironically, the first one's about defragging a hard drive, which you were just talking about.
There you go. Nice segue.
Yes. I have a regular desktop system with a spinning hard drive running Windows 10. And I read somewhere, tell me if I'm wrong about this, that Windows 10 automatically defrags the hard drive on occasion. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So I'm running also a utility program called System Mechanic. And it does a bunch of things to clean up the hard drive. And one of the things it does, every once in a while it pops up and it says System Mechanic defragmenting the hard drive. And I'm thinking, well, if Windows does it automatically, why would this program also do it? Don't the writers of the program realize that it's already being done by Windows? So wondering if I should keep the System Mechanic.
They probably think they do it better. And if they're a good enough programmer, they will have turned off Windows defragmentation to do their own. but you can't be sure of that, so it might be trying to defragment twice.
Right. And if it's just a spinning hard drive, yeah, you'll do a little more wear and tear on it. But particularly if it's defragging it often, that's not a big deal if it's a spinning hard drive.
Right, and it is.
Yeah. So they, in general, in both cases, once a good defragmentation is done, you theoretically aren't going to have all that much to defragment the next time, unless you do a whole lot of adding and removing programs.
Right. And then don't defragment for a year.
Right.
Yeah.
But in general, and certainly as we just said, with the HTFS?
NTFS. And HFS.
Right, the new technology new, file system.
Yeah. And from, HFS on the Mac is the hierarchical, so you merge them together.
Right. but in the mumble, whatever it is, you don't, the file system now, the way they're organized, defragmenting is less important because of read-aheads and all the other things that these things do nowadays. But yeah, once in a while, a couple of three times a year is really all you need it. If something is constantly defragmenting your hard drive, I don't know. I don't know that that's useful.
Okay, that answers that question. The other question has to do with backing up. I'm using Carbonite as a backup service, but I was looking into comparisons between Carbonite and iDrive. And apparently iDrive has a feature that Carbonite doesn't called disk imaging. I'm wondering if you could tell me what that is and if it's important enough for me to make the switch from Carbonite to iDrive.
Well, in general, a backup program gives you backed up files.
Right.
A backup image takes a complete
snapshot.
Virtual snapshot picture of your drive. And so in case of a drive failure, you can restore from that image a lot faster than needing to install your OS, install your apps, install the Carbonite app, and then restore your files. But you can do imaging yourself on a bunch of other programs and run it yourself. Typically, with an image backup, you would want a local hard drive to store that image to. I wonder if iDrive does local images or cloud images. I'm looking at it now.
The other thing is you need to stop and think about the circumstances under which hard drives die. If it died from a mechanical failure, then certainly a snapshot, a disk image from which you can restore is not a bad idea. But if it died because it got a virus or whatever other circumstance may be, how do you know that that's not embedded in the backup, in the disk image?
Right.
I believe that anytime I install a new hard drive or whatever, it's very little time and effort, honestly. Well, sometimes it's a lot of time, but it's really very little effort to install the operating system brand new.
And then you only install the apps you want now, not the hundreds of cruft that you had and
right.
don't use anymore.
Right.
Right.
I have to admit, because I use Linux, all my apps are free, and there's a couple of utilities that will back up the entire list of programs you have installed and then reinstall them on a new machine with just a couple of commands. It's a lot easier for me. But in any circumstance, I personally believe that if you've got a new hard drive or a new machine, install new. And you're not carrying over any problems.
Another one of the advantages of an image backup is many programs can make that image bootable. So you image it to another drive. And so we have a lot of business customers who do use imaging backup. So if a computer dies, they boot the image, and they're back up and running instantly. They don't even have to wait the hour
right.
it would take to reinstall
Rebuild
the OS.
It.
Yeah.
Right. And what I used to do when I was working, we bought everybody identical laptops, and we imaged the first one when it was correct.
Yep.
And then we just restored that image to all the new machines. So if somebody's machine died, we just pull one out of storage, image it. Half an hour later, they're up and running.
Yep.
So there are reasons to image, and they're good reasons. But you need to decide if your use case is what imaging is designed for.
Okay, and everything that you just said generated one more quick question.
Sure.
There is a piece of software I have on my machine that I use every once in a while. I don't want to lose it. The company that made it went out of business. It's not available anymore. If I lose it, I can't download it. If my hard drive dies, I have no way to restore this one program because it's just not available anymore. Now, there may be other programs that do the same thing, but by using a disk image, that program would just automatically come back. I wouldn't have to buy it again from another company that still makes something like that. Am I correct?
Yes.
Right. And in many cases, with something like that, keep the installer that you originally downloaded so that you can get it back again. I know a lot of people clean their installer folders out because you've installed it, you don't need it again. But in that off chance that the company goes away, you want to keep that last installer.
So if you have the installer, you can restore a program even if it's completely lost? I was never quite sure about that.
Well, it depends. When you never do easy. The installation, if it goes out and grabs components from the home base.
Or checks for license activation.
Yeah. Right. Then, no, if the company's out of business, you can't reinstall it.
Okay.
Because those ties are no longer there.
Right.
But a lot of times the installers are self-contained. And you can tell by the size. If it's like, you know, 20K, it's a stub and will download everything else. And you can usually tell during the install because it says downloading additional components or something like that. But if, you know, if it's a couple hundred megs, then it's probably the full installer.
Right.
Which is the old technology. Nowadays, they just do the stub.
Yep.
And quick do it. That way you could get the latest and greatest when you're downloading the program and installing it.
Not if you've got a second machine somewhere, the easiest way to do is to put the installer on that, run it, see what happens.
Especially disconnect it from the internet while you're installing it.
Right.
Yeah. Have it as standalone.
But that's really the only way to tell.
Okay. I think you answered my questions, and that's great. Again, have a good day. Yep.
You too. Keep smiling.
And
don't forget, spread the soundbites word in Pottstown.
Yeah. I will.
Yep. And even sometimes when the company still exists, but they don't support that program anymore, old versions of Adobe software, Microsoft software, they have stopped the activation servers for those old versions. And so even if you have a legitimate license that you purchased, you can't use it because the activation server is not running. And those companies assume you're a thief. So if the software can't activate, it assumes you stole it.
Yes, exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Brian from Gates, New York. Hi, Brian. What's up? Brian? Wake up, Brian.
He put us on hold.
If this is who I think it is, it's very possible that he did. Are you there?
No, that looks like we lost that call.
No, Brian.
Call back if you can.
Sorry, Brian.
Wait a minute.
He's going to try it again.
Somebody's Brian. Okay, let's try again.
There's this wonderful phone system that wasn't designed for call-in radio.
That's right. You know, God bless the folks here. They're doing yeoman service. All right, let's try it again. Brian from Gates, New York.
That's me.
There you are. What's up?
Email question.
Yeah.
All right. My machine is a Chrome box, full-size Chrome box, and I still use Roadrunner because I need it for a few things, and so that comes through the Spectrum mail server.
Right.
I've been getting a lot of crap mail over the last couple weeks, and it's obviously a random generated name, and the address, or the subject actually, no, the address is the first part of my Roadrunner account.
Mm-hmm.
And then an ad, if I open it, it's some ad for a drugstore I never go to or a department store that I almost never go to.
Right.
It's nothing important. It's just crap.
Right.
So I close it, or I don't even open them anymore. I just flag it, block it, and then report it as spam, and it goes away.
Right.
Okay. That's good. But I don't know if there's any way of permanently blocking them so I don't even have to look at them.
Let me finish.
It'll go.
So go ahead. If you block
that subject of B McNulty 1, all my regular mail would probably get blocked.
Right, if you're blocking the email address.
Right.
And it's coming from multiple different email addresses.
It seems to be, yes.
Yeah, wherever they tapped into. And like anything else we've said for years, it's just like viruses. They're always playing leapfrog. You patch one, and they're going to find another route. So, yeah, if you go ahead and block that one, you're going to be probably blocking a lot more that you didn't want to.
Part of the problem is that the folks at Roadrunner do not have a good spam blocker.
I'll just figure that part out.
I remember in the early days they got in trouble for blocking too much spam.
Right.
Things that weren't really spam.
Right.
I think the sender is just a name generator.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
And those types of messages are very hard to block against.
Very hard to block.
Theoretically, you could log into the web server and put a block there. And then you won't see the message on your computer because the server's already blocked it before it gets to your computer.
Assuming they use the same address twice.
That's the problem, yeah.
So one thing...
It seems to be almost like a random generated address.
Right.
Is there a subject line that's similar enough?
Right.
Yeah.
Or you can say, all right, let's say if it's a picture, that's hard. If it's text, and I don't use Roadrunner, so I don't know, but they're also Yahoo. They're actually Yahoo.
No, Frontier is Yahoo.
Oh, Frontier is Yahoo. Was he at Roadrunner?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to, so if you go into Roadrunner, if you can block by text in the body, then you can block any text that is, for example, the name of the pharmacy you never go to.
Mm.
But that's really kind of it. There are a couple of other email systems like Gmail and even Outlook that do a much better job of blocking spam.
Yeah, I got a Gmail account too, and that works fine.
Yeah.
It never comes through the Gmail one.
One of the things to check is to make sure you've switched your mail server settings from the old Roadrunner settings to the new TWC settings. So it used to be pop-server.rochester.com,
right.
And now it's mail.twc.com. We're wondering if they're going to switch to Spectrum settings now that Spectrum owns Time Warner Internet.
Who knows?
But we have seen a little better response from the mail.twc.com server. And it can also stop some error messages because I don't think they're renewing the SSL certs on the old server addresses. So we've had a lot of customers that are coming in and they're getting these error messages about an insecure mail server. So, well, yeah, because you know that's the 20-year-old server. You want to go to the 10-year-old server.
Yeah, right.
Now, just a similar issue with a different outcome. I got one of these suspicious ones that came up, and it wasn't just a first name and an initial. It was the full name, first and last name of a person I know.
Oh, yeah.
And I know the person. It's a gentleman who is in his mid-80s or so. And it was, could you tell me where I could find an iTunes card for my niece's birthday?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. That's a common one.
Yeah, I kind of figured it was. But I know the guy. And I said, oh,
all right, hold on. We gotta take a break.
Oh, I didn't hear the music. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll be back.
But hang on. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with Brian from Gates, and with me, Nick Francesco. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. It's Soundbites right here in the truly great and truly grateful to you that we are member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we still have Brian from Gates, New York, right here on the line. Brian, go ahead.
Well, thanks for taking a commercial break. It gave me a chance to finish my lunch.
Excellent.
You're so considerate.
It's our pleasure.
Anyway, finish the story. It's a real quick finish. I sent back a note, said, well, you can buy those at XYZ department store. I got one just a couple days ago for my favorite coffee lady who did some sewing work for me.
There you go.
There you go. And he writes back, or he or she, the name was a man. Oh, good. Go buy $600 worth of iTunes cards.
Wow.
In $100 increments. Scratch off the PIN number and send it to me.
Yeah. Nice.
Well, you got me beat, Brian.
So yeah,
before I did.
Right. Yeah. I bet you went out and bought them.
Yep.
I screamed up. What I wanted to do was write back to the address and said, and tell him the truth. You're an Episcopal priest. What are you doing asking me to do grand larceny?
Yeah, right. All right. So this, for everybody else, this is actually a really common thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I figured as much.
Anytime, what happens is somewhere along the line, they scraped up his address. And mm-hmm. so many addresses are out there, or somebody gets hit with a virus and steals all their address book and et cetera, et cetera. So getting addresses is really quite easy.
Absolutely.
Then what they do is they ask you for these PIN numbers off of items that you buy, off of gift cards you buy. And the idea is the gift card itself is worthless. What's important is that PIN number on the back.
Right.
So you can buy the card, read the PIN number to somebody, and then throw away the card.
And the money's gone in seconds.
In half a second.
Yeah.
Really.
As fast as they can type it in.
Number. Yep.
And so we see that a lot. In general, for everyone listening, if you ever get somebody telling you to buy gift cards from anywhere and send them the PIN number.
Even if it's from someone you think you know, it's not.
Right. It's not from them. It is a scam. Do not do it.
We had a customer that got taken for over $20,000.
Jeez and crackers.
Because Apple called her and said there's a problem with her computer and she needed to go to stores. So she went to all the stores and bought all their gift cards while they kept her on the phone.
Wow.
And your computer's only worth $1,000. Why did you think 20? Well, they scared me. I didn't think that far. And we're actually seeing a lot of the store clerks are getting wise and being trained to this scam. So if you try to buy too many cards, they try to warn you about it. We thought that was bad, 20 grand. Until we had another customer.
Beat that?
They got him in. They got into his foundation bank account and took hundreds of thousands.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Brian, this week they were trying to get me for 5 gift cards.
Yep.
And it was a guy that I knew, you know, from the Rara, and he's the president. And they were trying to scam me into going out and getting 5.
Rara is the Rochester Area Radio Association.
Yeah. Getting
Rochester Amateur Radio
Association. And get 5 $100 cards. You know, the one thing, I got him, you know, like I said, I played him along for 4 days. And he was really getting antsy. Oh, yeah. I love having fun with him, just like Nick. I've learned from him. You know what would have been the best is if I could have had, you know, one of those gift cards with a, you know, a scratch off.
Yeah, one that you already scratched off.
Right, yeah, I got to save one so that way I can pretend I'm scratching it off, give them that number, and then just add another number onto that for the next one, because usually they want.
Sure.
Oh, I could have some fun with
you
that.
You can have some fun with that.
Oh.
I once got an email telling me that my son.
Mm-hmm.
Was yeah, exactly that my son was stuck in I forget what country and needed gift card money to get
him out.
Lost my passport or money was stolen.
Right. And I thought, well, there's only 2 things wrong with that.
Did you write back and say he's a smarmy little thing and I hate him, let him rot in hell?
What I did, I wrote back and said, I've never liked you, I've disowned you already, never write to me again.
Yeah, we had a customer that happened to him, and he'd bought several thousand dollars of gift cards and was trying to sell them back to us. He didn't buy them from us. No one will return gift cards because it's so easy to steal the money off. You can't prove there's any money left. But he bought all these cards before he thought to call his grandson and ask him how he was doing.
Yeah, right.
They call with this panic in their voice.
I got hit for six. As Nick says, the price of poker keeps going up.
Up. Absolutely. They want to come back for more.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
They did. Our one customer, 6 months later, they called back and with the same sort of spiel again, saying there was another problem with her computer because they got money out of her the first time. She got most of it back on her credit card as fraudulent transactions, but the bad guys kept the money.
The thing of it is, folks, like Nick was saying, anytime you get an email or phone call and they want you to go out and purchase gift cards, hang up or erase the email.
It's a scam. Mm-hmm.
One or the other.
Right.
Do not reply back to them. Do not acknowledge it because it only fuels them on. Unless you want to have some fun and play along with them.
Unless you're willing to play.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was fun. And I was,
getting for a while after I retired, it was my hobby.
Yeah. I got a big charge out. The wife kept saying, what are you doing? And she... Oh, here.
Yeah, let me help.
She wanted to get in on it.
Got to do something with my time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this whole interchange was three emails, less than 4 hours.
Yeah.
And it was done.
Well, you've got time on your hands. You could have fun with them.
Yeah. And for everyone, you can go to haveibeenpwned.com and type in your email address and see where your email address has been breached by problems. And then that address is compromised. And it will even often tell you what information was taken. So some of the breaches are just your email address. Some might be your name, your address. There's social securities. There's passwords. A lot of things have been lost in a lot of different breaches.
All right. So what's that address, Dave?
Have I been pwned? PWNED.
Steve will put up a link on the website.
We got to move on to the next caller.
Yeah, go. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks. Yeah, one of my email addresses. I have so many email addresses. One of my email addresses is pwned on 8 breach sites.
Yep. Many of the password managers now look at this website,
right,
to see and warn you when a new breach happens and you happen to lose your information.
Right. All right. Our next caller is Andy from Greece, New York. Hi, Andy. What's up?
Just a follow-up to the Firefox 64-bit problem I was having last week. It was not Flash, which you had thought it was. In digging in, I sent an email over to Alan.
You're breaking up. I can hardly hear you.
Do you want me to call back?
No, that was clearer.
Okay. I had sent an email over to ESL, and they responded and said they tested against 64-bit, and it worked perfectly. They were looking into their site, and why did I think the problem was with their site? And I'm sure there was a tone of righteous indignation that the email did not convey well. So I started digging. I said, well, if they can make it work, what did I do wrong? And I started digging through everything and all the settings and everything. So I finally got down to extensions and add-ons. Under extensions, I did find Flash, but it was grayed out and marked disabled. So I moved to add-ons, and there was the Facebook containment one that I had put in there, and then there was a second one that I don't remember ever putting in there, and it was Malwarebytes Browser Defender.
Interesting.
Now, I do have the pro version of Malwarebytes, and I know they've been sending me all kinds of messages every time I use the thing to go through my system. Do you want us to protect you on the Internet? And I think at one point, to shut them up, I think I said yes.
Yeah.
Where that probably came from.
Yep.
So anyhow, I looked at it and I went, all right, let's give it a try. So I turned it off, got out, got back in, immediately went into ESL with no trouble at all.
Yep.
I found my culprit. So then I went out and started doing some research on Malwarebytes site to find out exactly what the Browser Defender was. And it actually just sits there quietly in the background and protects you against 4 categories of things. There's ad/tracking, malware, scams, and pups, PUPS.
Unwanted programs.
Oh, I figured it wasn't the 4-legged variety.
Right.
But anyhow, so you can create a white, it says, what do you do if it blocks you from a legitimate site. And it said you go in and create a whitelist. So I put ESL.org on the whitelist, and then it gives you the four options, and you can cancel whichever one of those you want. So I did the ad slash tracking, because I know ESL tracks.
Right.
So I took that out and saved it and went to go back and got back in immediately. So if you run into this problem, go check your add-ons, and if you have the malware, especially if you've got the professional paid version of Malwarebytes, take a look and make sure it's there. And if it is, you just turn off, you go into ESL or whatever site and turn off the ad tracking and leave the other three because those are pretty bad. And your problem should be fixed.
Perfect. Thanks, Andy.
Not a problem. I thought I'd get back to you with that one.
Appreciate
it. I know Flash gets blamed for a lot of things, but couldn't blame it for this one.
Right.
Also, this coming Thursday's first Thursday of the month.
Right.
So, Rochester, I don't know, are we doing a live meeting or are we doing an online meeting?
I think we're not doing a live meeting. I think any place that we would normally meet is not yet allowing live meetings. So
okay.
I'm sure it'll be another
virtual
meeting.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And as always, I'll keep listening.
All right. Have fun.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
A lot of times we see that programs that offer 32-bit versions and 64-bit versions in separate installers, it doesn't work to just install the 64-bit version. You have to uninstall the 32-bit first, then install the 64-bit. So like Firefox, yeah, it's 64-bit if you've installed the 64-bit version and didn't have the 32-bit ahead of
time. Because often any installer will say, oh, no, this is already installed. It doesn't look at the bit size.
Yeah.
It just does it. So... do you want to do, you said you had some text?
Yeah.
Would you rather do those first?
Yeah.
Got to turn my mic back on. All right. Hold on a second here. Let me go over to the screen. Yeah, we had.
Before you get there, I should tell people, call us at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or text us as these people have done on the brand new text line. 585-205-8887. Go.
And we've got the first, this is from JW. What router do you recommend when installing Greenlight Internet service? Thanks, JW.
Okay, there's two things. One is the tiny little box that they give you, which is the converter from, it's an OAN, optical something network, and that little box they give you, but then you want to put it on your own router.
Right, that converts from fiber to ether.
Yep. Right, so now you have to make a decision. The first decision is, how fast is your Greenlight connection? If you only have the 500 meg connection...
Only 500.
Right, then you only need the 500 meg... you only need a router that does 500 meg. But if you've got the gig or 2 gig, then you need a router that does those speeds. So that's your first decision. Your second decision is, how big is your house and how powerful do you need that router to be? And do you need a mesh router instead of a regular router? Or do you just need repeaters or whatever? That's a much, much longer discussion. But in general, any of the modern... routers like the Google Nest mesh router or the Netgear Orbi routers are excellent choices.
You want at least an AC router. So that's something you're going to look for in the name. It's an AC, which is or Wi-Fi 6 is the newest name. AC was Wi-Fi 5.
Well, but also, do your devices do that? Because if you still got an old thing that only does A and B.
Yep.
And you get Wi-Fi 6, then you're out of luck.
Well, then don't get Greenlight. Save it for me.
One thing I would interject there, and you know, say right now you only have 500 meg,
right?
500 gig. Don't limit yourself, because all of a sudden, if you want to jump up, you're now taking that new router,
throwing it away,
or giving it to somebody else because you got to now upgrade to a full gig.
And the difference between the routers that do 500 meg and the routers that do a gig is fairly small. So.
Yeah, it's nominal, but it'll be worth it down the road if you want to up your game.
Right.
And Greenlight has a list of recommended routers, which is pretty much every router, but
right.
they have a list.
But Steve will put a link to that yeah. up
the
on our
list. The easiest one I found, and that was, again, due to you, was I switched over to the Orbi.
Very nice router.
You know, I needed to get one and because I used to have Spectrum, and they took that one. You know, I turned that thing back in and got the Orbi. That was so easy. Just literally plug it in, you're done.
Yep.
Plug and go. And the dashboard is so easy to work with and set things up. If you want to, you know, give static IP addresses to different things, you can set it up in there, and it's very user-friendly.
Yeah. One of the things I found in switching routers for customers is that if you forget how many other things you have on your network. I'll often do a network map, and there's 25 devices on your network. What? It's only my husband's computer and mine. And both of your tablets and both of your phones and your security system and your five cameras and your televisions and your thermostats. And
your smart speakers and probably your cat.
Yep. So if you make, when you set up your new router, if you make the network name exactly the same spelling.
As the old one.
As the old one. I had one where I had a curly quote instead of a straight quote, and that was a problem.
It's a problem.
And the same password. Most of the time, all the other devices will rejoin the new network normally.
Right.
If you create a whole different network name, you're now going to have to go around to every single one of your devices and rejoin the network, which isn't too bad on your phone and your tablet, but it can be tricky on your smart speaker. Well,
remembering
and your cameras
how to do it or going back and finding out how to do it again, I know that's hard. All right, you had another text message?
Yep, we got another one here. All right, it says, update. I called last week about an Excel spreadsheet that I uploaded to Google Sheets. The values on the vertical axis did not come through properly, and I couldn't change them. Once I saved the spreadsheet as a Google Docs, everything on the spreadsheet was the way it was supposed to be. Google Sheets imports everything correctly, but for some reason, it couldn't handle the values of the vertical axis while it was still a Microsoft product.
A conversion error, and once you save it in the new format, it worked.
It works. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Absolutely. All right, is there another?
No.
We're back to the phones?
You were back to the phone.
All right, our next caller is George from Rochester, New York. Hi, George, what's up?
Hi. I have a Gmail account. And then I have a second one, which I use as an alternate. I have two iPads and an iPhone. I get my mail on this primary and the secondary on the one iPad, but I can't get it on the second iPad and on the iPhone. I'm assuming there's some kind of a setting someplace that I'm have wrong.
Yep. Yeah, you have to go into the settings app, and then under passwords and accounts, it will list all of your accounts. You may not have set it up at all yet. Did you ever get the mail on that device?
I don't remember.
Yeah, so it will be listed in your passwords and accounts. If it isn't there, then you tap on add account and say Google, and then you're going to give it your email address and your password. If it is there and not working, then it probably needs you to enter your password again. So you tap on the one that is there, and it will probably say, please enter your password.
Just tap on the password that's there?
Yeah, tap on the account name that's there, and then it will probably ask for your password back again.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it does ask for my password.
Yep.
But I put a password in that I thought it was.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Sometimes that can be a problem. A lot of programs ask for your password every now and then to make sure it's really you there. But if you put in the wrong password, then now it has saved the wrong password along with the right password. And so when it tries to log in again, you don't know whether it's going to save the right password or the wrong password.
Yeah. Well, I go to my iPad that does get the mail, and I look for the password in the keychain, and I get the password, and I put that one in, and it doesn't recognize it or something.
We would need to know the exact error message. If it says password is invalid, or if it says username not found, or if it says something like can't verify, there's a lot of different error messages, and each one points to something else.
It always says cancel or password. That's what it was.
So probably the password you entered was incorrect.
So how can I overcome that?
Type in the correct password.
If you don't know the correct password, then you can go to the Google.
I forgot. Well, just go to gmail.com, try to log in.
Exactly.
And there's a button there that says forgot password, and it will prompt you through the steps to reset your password.
Okay, I'll give that a try. Thanks, guys.
Yep. All right, good luck.
It's one of the things, it's very convenient that your devices remember passwords for you, but then when you need to type it in, you don't remember it because you haven't had to type it 100 times a day.
All right, we got a quick question before the break. We got a minute here. It says, does paid version of Revo have any features to clean up junk that comes with a new computer? Yes.
He probably wants a little more. You got 30 seconds.
Oh, well, yeah, no, there is a lot of great features to it. You know, it's constantly updating, and the way that it cleans out, like we've said before, you know, if you use the Windows uninstaller, that just turns one bit off, and it makes your registry very bulky, slows down the machine. Well, all those things need to be pulled out of there. And with Revo, it not only goes through the folders, but it also goes into the registry deep and cleans out all that junk. So you're keeping your machine nice and clean and slim and runs more efficiently. You don't want to, you know, just use the Windows one. Use the Revo. It's well worth the price. I mean, I've upgraded it on three of my machines, and I love it.
In Windows 10, you'll get a lot of cruft. There's games and all kinds of stuff you don't need. Those can be removed. I think there are some programs in Windows S that cannot be removed.
Yeah.
But if it's just regular Windows 10, then you can remove all of those things.
You can get it out of there, and like I say, do an advance. Don't be afraid of it. The advance just goes a little bit deeper, cleans all that stuff out, and you know, keeps the machine running a lot smoother.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So yes, you can, unless it's Windows S. And Revo will tell you if it can uninstall something, so it's not that big a deal.
And I've posted the link with the differences between your three versions.
Perfect. All right, we're going to take a quick break, actually a slightly longer break. We've wasted an hour of our time here this morning and this afternoon, and we'll be doing it again on the other side of this break. It's going to be a slightly longer break, so if you need to take a little bio break or just get up and dance from sheer exuberance, you can do that. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick, Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. We are Soundbites, right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you that with your continued support, we remain member-supported. Jazz 90.1. We will see you on the other side.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece, Rochester.
A public service of the Greece Central School District.
Jazz 90.1.
On Instagram at WGMC Jazz 901.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour. We are hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites right here on the truly great member supported Jazz 90.1. What are you laughing at now?
That picture still, I can't.
It's a good picture.
It looks like he.
I know what it looks like.
He must not have seen it yet.
He hasn't demanded we take it down.
He is. But he posted, I did see that picture.
He posted it
on Facebook, and I think he.
It's the kiddie plane at the airport.
That little not kiddie plane what ride. It looks.
I know that. All right, but he's very happy to be there wherever he is. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Hi, Mark. What's up?
Hi, guys. Long time no talk. Sorry, I've been only texting. I've been a few weeks past now. My daughter got ready to go back to college, and she's finishing the last 2 years over at Oswego.
Good for her.
So that's where she's going. So I'm sorry, not Oswego, Geneseo.
That's well, a big difference.
Wait a minute. Which one did you drop her off at?
Yeah.
No. I have a mental block with that one for some reason. I don't know why, but
sure.
I do. Anyways, gentleman talked about malware bytes in his browser.
Right.
You know, as an add-on. Fantastic add-on.
Yeah, it is.
Fantastic add-on. And another one I think people should use because that catches a lot, but another one that catches a lot also is the Komodo add-on called Online Security Pro.
Yep.
And that'll stop things right in its tracks.
Yep.
And it's another good one. So I suggest both those if you're doing a lot of banking.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But as Andy said, you have to be aware that it can block things you want.
Exactly.
You can whitelist them, but it will do it.
Yep. It's the same thing with, like, ad blockers.
Yep, exactly right.
Certain sites without whitelisting them.
Exactly right.
The way it is, yeah. Another thing is for all our friends that are still hesitating about going to Linux or at least trying it on a second computer, I love this one. I just tried another distro, and it's the Linux FX, the one that looks just like Windows 10.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. If you're really shaky about going to Linux, this one makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, because that front end looks very, very similar.
Very, very similar. Very similar. And I loaded Wine on it, and how much fun I'm having with that.
Yeah.
the other thing is I loaded the desktop picture of the Windows 10 window with the light coming through it, and the little the penguin that Linux uses.
Yes.
Peeking through the window.
Yeah, oh, that's very nice. Funny. That's very funny. I like it.
Yeah, it's great. So I highly suggest that to anybody, especially on an old computer. It recognized everything on this Dell Optiplex I've got. It only has 4 gigs of memory in it, and an old Core 2 Duo 2.1 gigabyte processor.
You'll find that's fine for Linux.
And it works.
Doesn't need it.
If you just have a decent, not even great, two-core processor, it will work. And 4 gigs of memory is more than enough for something like that.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, it's a lot. I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Right, and it's very cool. And if you are interested in looking at it, Linux FX is all one word. Just do a Google search for that, and you'll find it.
Yeah, I get it, because I'm afraid eventually there's going to be a lawsuit on their hands, I think.
They're in Brazil, so I don't know.
Well, you know Microsoft. They have a far reach.
That's true. It's also, that's perfect. And WindowsFX.org. Interesting.
It's hosted at SourceForge, like a lot of them are.
Right. And it also has its own URL.
I was using Mint, which I love.
Yeah, Mint is nice, too.
And then I tried this. I said, I can always go back. And, wow, this is so much fun. I did give my sister-in-law Mint because all she does is go on the Internet, and they have this old PC, this old laptop. I said, let me put it on there for you. I said, it's like a regular computer, and you're only going on the Internet. You're going to love it. She absolutely loves it.
Good. Excellent.
So don't be afraid, guys. Try.
Yep.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Have fun with it. Why not?
Oh, I'm having a ball, so.
There are Linux distributions that look like Mac OS. There are Linux distributions that look like Windows 10 or Windows 95. There's
if
a Linux
really
distribution.
Funky, do Ubuntu. That's really funky.
Right,
funky.
Yeah, Ubuntu's funky. There's one that looks like the B OS, which is very cool. You can get a front end that looks like anything you like.
And they have a couple that allow you to modify the front ends easily.
any one of them do. You can change your front end regularly. I use XFCE simply because when I first started using it, it was the lightest and fastest, and I just wanted the speed. That was the only thing that was important to me. And so I still use it because I've been using it for 25 years. But you can change it easily and regularly without reinstalling the entire distribution.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
So just wanted to have to say thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have fun.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yep.
I'm trying to find the English language version of their website because...
I did.
It's in Portuguese.
Right. And I did
Google Translate.
Chrome, and it includes Google Translate automatically. So you just hit a button and bang, you're in English. So, there's also a program called Rocket Chat, which does automatic language translation. It's a text chat program, but it will do automatic language translation for you.
Oh, so you could type it in English and it'll translate in Chinese?
Yeah.
Or whatever language you want?
Yeah, back and forth, no problem. It was originally in, it originally used Google Translate, but now the Google charges. It uses Bing Translate, which is adequate. Okay. And the other thing I discovered while looking at it yesterday, you can run it on a Raspberry Pi 4.
Ooh.
And I really, really, really wanted it to set it up. Now, my Raspberry Pi 4 is just in my house, so I would be talking to myself,
mm-hmm.
which I do anyway, but so I don't really have a need to. But if you've got a 2-gig machine, it'll do 50 people simultaneously. A 4-gig machine will do 1,000 people simultaneously. And an 8-gig machine will do 2,000 people simultaneously with translations.
Yeah, well, but if you have it, you know... that you can speak into it and feed out of the Raspberry Pi.
No, this is text. This is not.
Oh, okay.
This is just texting. So you type in English, and the other person can say, "I want to see it in Spanish or Chinese or whatever it happens to be." It was very, very clever, very cool. So it's a chat program, kind of like Discord or one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But it does auto translation on the fly, which I thought was pretty cool for a free program you could load on your own machine. So if you've got a small network in your business,
that'd be cool.
You know, throw a Raspberry Pi 4 on there and you win. Or, of course, you can do, there are programs that give you an external address
mm-hmm.
that translates in for you, and so that'll work. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Penfield, New York. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Hi, guys. I've got a Chromebook, and I used it fine last night. And this morning, turned it on, and because I turned it off because I thought we might get some thunderstorms, I like to leave it off.
Sure.
Turned it back on, and I had no internet and no way to find it even. I was just kind of in limbo, it seemed like. And I don't know, messed around all morning and this, that, the other thing, and finally... a little while ago, it showed up. Well, here's networks again, and picked the one, and finally got logged in. I don't know what happened in the interim, where everything went.
It wanted to rest.
Give it a rest, the poor thing. It wanted you to, learn the banjo or something for a while. Get off the internet. To me, sounds like a hardware issue. What is the model of your Chromebook?
It's an Acer R13.
Okay. Acer. Learn to spell. Jeez and crackers.
I let Google spell check fix it for me.
Yeah, not when you can't spell R13. I'm looking to see if there's some sort of... switch to turn off the internet on these things.
Yeah, because a lot of laptops have a little switch that turns off your Wi-Fi to save battery. And we've seen quite frequently people accidentally switch that switch.
Right. And you can certainly turn off the internet just by clicking on that little thing in the lower right, whose name I can never remember. and bring up the thing and just click on the
connections listing.
Well, once you bring it up, you get a connections listing, yeah. And you can toggle that off and on.
I wasn't getting the listing. I couldn't bring it up.
Well, no, just when you that was good. When you click on the time, for example, in the lower right, it brings up that gray box.
Right.
And one of the things in that gray box should be your Wi-Fi connection, and it may be off or on. And then until it's on, you'll never see the networks that are available to you. So if it was turned off accidentally by clicking it or whatever, and then you accidentally clicked on it again and turned it on, that would explain what happened. So you could go to it now, and it's probably, if you're on the latest version of Chrome, that box is gray and the connection is blue. The circle is blue.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And if you click on the circle, not on the name under it, but on the circle itself, it should turn. It should turn Wi-Fi off completely.
I'm a little hesitant to even try.
No, I get that. I absolutely get that. But I'm just telling you that's what happens. Oh, okay. And so, if you had done that accidentally, it would turn it off. And then until you accidentally clicked on it again to turn it back on, you won't see any networks. You won't even see networks to connect to because you've told it, ignore the Wi-Fi.
Had you rebooted the machine between it not working and it working?
Well, I had it. I turned it off. Yeah, so yeah. Then I turned it back on, and
maybe that was enough for it to redetect the network settings.
Maybe, but
when I first turned it on this morning, I had no
right.
Internet.
Normally, that connection decision you made. Whether accidentally or on purpose, that decision remains between things. Mm. So you must have at some point reclicked it. Anyway, I'm glad you found it.
Right. Now I've got the old LastPass won't let me log in again problem. So I think I'm about due for a new password manager.
Oh, yeah. LastPass has had a few issues. We've been recommending EnPass, ENPASS, and I personally much prefer that over LastPass.
I hate to change software, but I think that's my only resort here. I can't keep going through this can't log in thing.
No, I believe me, I absolutely get it. And you can, I don't know why that keeps happening. All right, you can convert. From LastPass to EnPass, and there's a thing you can do. So in LastPass, you go to More Options, Advanced, Export.
I'm finding a tutorial. Yeah,
Steve is going to find a tutorial and post it on our website. But basically, you export everything from LastPass. And then import it to EnPass. And one of the things under File Import, one of the choices will be LastPass.
Sounds good.
So they make it as easy as possible to do. And I think you'll find it much easier.
Right now, easy sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I bet. All right, good luck.
Thanks.
Yep, bye-bye.
Now, Google's spell checker said, did I mean convert LastPass to KeyPass? No, I said EnPass.
No, I would have said KeyPass if I meant KeyPass. That's one of the amusing things to me is...
some of the words it suggests.
Is some of the suggestions that it makes, yeah.
It's like, where the heck did you think that one up?
Yep. Do we have a text message?
Nope.
Okay. Then I will read a news item. WordPress for iOS, this was a great story, is a free app that connects to the company's free open source content management system, which millions of sites around the web use for some part of their structure. WordPress, the company, also sells domain names and array of personal business and enterprise web hosting packages. Apple, unfortunately, seems to have mixed the two and briefly forced WordPress to add in-app purchases that it otherwise wouldn't have so that Apple could take a cut. Because of the agreement developers make with Apple to have their apps approved for the App Store, 30% of any purchase made through the WordPress app after the functionality was added would have gone to Apple. The problem here, of course, is that there is absolutely nothing to purchase in the free app connecting to the free content management system.
Yeah.
Oops. However, Apple does seem to have realized it messed up and has reversed its ruling. It seems Apple may be feeling a bit besieged over its App Store terms at the moment, as its 30% of cut of purchases and the fact that some very large firms are able to negotiate better terms is the center of international attention. Less than 2 weeks ago, Fortnite developer Epic Games deliberately flouted Apple's in-app purchase rule to goad Apple into banning it from the platform. Immediately after Apple did so, Epic filed a civil antitrust suit accusing Apple of harming competitors through anti-competitive terms. In the days since, the case has only escalated. Apple threatened removal not only of Epic's games, but also of Unreal Engine from both iOS and Mac, which led Microsoft to join the legal fray on Epic's side. Competition regulators around the world have also been closely scrutinizing Apple's App Store terms. The European Union opened a formal probe into Apple's pricing practices following a 2019 complaint from music streaming service Spotify. Messaging app Telegram also filed a complaint with the EU last summer. U.S. regulators, too, have been probing Apple alongside Google, Amazon, and Facebook over potentially anti-competitive behavior. Although Apple maintains it applies its App Store policies evenly across all developers, documents made public during a congressional hearing in July reveal that some developers, including Amazon Prime Video, were able to negotiate significant discounts. So do you realize that the 30% fee is increasing costs to you? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
That must have sparked... When you said any text, boom, boom, we got two in.
Okay, well,
the
wait a minute. Let's finish talking about this first.
Yes, just so you know, we got two. Yeah.
Perfect.
The one thing that always annoys me about this story, because it's been going around, same thing happens in the Google Store.
Well, I said...
And Fortnite specifically didn't want to pay Google the 30% cut. So they made a side-loaded version of Fortnite.
Right.
And within an hour, hundreds of fake Fortnites came out you could side-load malware onto your phone.
Right.
And 10 years ago when the App Store came out, most distribution companies took 70% for themselves and you got 30%.
Right.
So Apple reversed that. Everyone was excited. You mean we get to keep 70%? 10 years before that, it was 90% that the store kept. And you, the guy that wrote the program, got 5% if you were lucky. Because it had to go through distribution. It had to go through licensing. It had to go through packaging. It had to go through duplication of the discs.
A lot of fingers hit it.
Yeah. If you want to get your store, you want to get your product in a box store, they set the prices. You're lucky to get 10% of the price they set it at.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so the electronic stores have been a boon to small developers in making a fortune.
That's right.
Fortnite just happens to be making $1 million a day.
Yes.
On a free game. $1 million a day.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to give Apple 30% of that. I don't blame them.
Right.
But if they had to do it themselves, it would be worse.
Right. But see, it's the new normal.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now, 30%. So now that's too much.
That's too much, yeah. So maybe 20%. And in another 10 years, they'll be complaining again.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly right.
Never happy.
And it's the storage. All the apps are stored on Apple servers. The distribution, global distribution.
Well, be fair, one copy.
True.
It's just
well,
one copy.
Well, not necessarily, because it's different languages or different copies.
No, sometimes, they're just
sometimes,
add-ons.
Yeah. And then you've got the currency exchange. You've got the transaction fees. Somebody joked about that's the reason Apple got into the credit card business, because they didn't want to pay transaction fees.
Right.
So now they pay themselves the transaction. I bet they do somewhere inside of Apple.
It's buried.
The transaction fee goes from this department at Apple to the other department at Apple.
Yep.
We used to have that all the time, funny money. You can't take it. That pot is empty.
Yeah.
But I got all this money in this other pot. Well, you can't use it because it's in a different pot. It's all the same bank account.
Yeah.
It's just in a different pot.
Remember one of the early Superman movies with Richard Pryor?
Richard Pryor.
Where he wrote the program to capture fractional interest. And at the end of a couple of days, he thought he'd have a dollar or two, and he had millions.
Yep. All right, we should go to the texts and see who's texted in.
All right, we've got first, guys, I have an older HP all-in-one. It goes on, but no response to anything. Just a black screen. Any ideas to this?
Yes. It involves, do you have a pistol permit? the fact is that it depends on how old it is. It's certainly going to need to be looked at by somebody.
Yeah.
It's clearly a hardware issue.
Yeah, especially those all-in-ones. You don't know. You got to listen to see if it's actually spinning up. But if nothing's coming on, it could be the power pack. But I'd first go back to, like you said, first, how old is it? Is it worth putting the money in it? Because that's where these all-in-ones, you know,
it's not cheap.
Yeah, you start
to fix.
They're cheap. They're not inexpensive power supplies and everything else because it is a special unit. You just can't go over to the store and buy any power supply. You've got to get the one made for that.
Right.
And that can be costly. So
now the first thing, of course, to check is if you've got the brightness and contrast all the way down.
Yeah,
I mean, that's typical on anything. Check that.
Open the door. Where'd that door come from?
Yeah, right.
To turn the knob up.
Right.
Actually, none of the monitors have doors anymore
because
people couldn't find the knobs.
That's right. So that's just push buttons on the back. But check to see that the contrast and the brightness are up. If it's not that, then really somebody's going to have to take a look at it. And you will pay a diagnostic fee just to get it looked at.
Yeah, and just see if it is even booting up or worth putting any money into it.
Right.
All right, the next one is, this is kind of long. Windows is 32-bit, but I don't have accurately know what the Intel processor is. Hi, how are you? This is the way this is reading.
Yep.
In an effort to get that information, I went to Dell's website support page, but the CSV specs sheet that I downloaded didn't have any content. Basically, this laptop is no longer supported by Dell. So so now how do I find out whether the processor is 32 or 64-bit?
Well, there are a couple of ways you can tell. You say you've already gone to Dell's website, which means you put in your serial number or model number.
Yep.
You can do a search for that model number. Okay.
Hold on. Wait. He put a little more just above that. I have a Dell Latitude D620 with Windows 7.
D620. Usually, you go to Windows settings about, it tells you what the processor is.
Yeah.
And
it'll tell you it's 32-bit or 64-bit.
Right.
It may not tell you that on the processor, but it will tell you that on Windows.
Yep.
But then you can look up that processor number, Google that, and find out what it is.
Right. Just so you know, this is Will in Hampton, Virginia.
Welcome, Will.
Will. Yeah, we're frantically looking that up ourselves.
According to
Google. We do that, tell you what. You guys continue looking that up, and we're going to take a short little break here, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We'll answer Will's question and get back to you. So just stay tuned, and we'll be back with more.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. And we were talking about a text from Will in Hampton, PA, in VA, Hampton, Virginia. About a Dell Latitude D620. It is indeed a 64-bit processor. It is a Core 2 Duo. It is capable of 64-bit work. It's not going to be fast. If you want to put something like Windows 10 on it, it's going to be slow. It'll run if you've got at least 2 gigs of RAM. 4 would be way better. It will run, but it's going to be slow.
It uses the 65-nanometer process, and right now we're on 7-nanometer.
Right.
That was a long time ago.
We should also mention that Steve's Mac spontaneously rebooted.
But it picked a good time to do it during the sponsorship break.
Right. So those of you who suddenly stopped hearing the stopped watching the YouTube stream, you can restart it and you'll see it again. It's now
there's now a second stream on YouTube.
Right, part 2. So you'll see that in just a minute. 3 of you have figured that out already. It spontaneously rebooted. It is an SSD, so it quickly rebooted.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gerald from Rochester, New York. Hiya, Gerald. What's up? Gerald? Hold on,
Hello?
Gerald. Oh, there you are.
Hello.
What's up?
Yes, I have an old laptop running Windows Vista, and I don't use it very much, but I have some pictures on there that I want to download to a Toshiba hard drive. And it tells me import pictures. Would that actually take all the pictures from the laptop and put it on the hard drive, or just make copies of that?
That's usually the other way. When you import from the computer in the computer, it goes from a camera into the computer. You want to drag the pictures from the computer to the external hard drive.
What program is telling you to import?
Let me see here. It's Windows. It's let me see. I can't see it right now, but that's one of the options: is import pictures to the hard drive.
It thinks you have a camera connected, and that's one of the options, is to import those pictures to that hard drive on the computer.
Right, so that takes them from whatever that external source is, and then imports them into that old Vista machine.
You want to look for an export command.
Are you on the old Vista machine?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So import means put them on the Vista machine. Export would take them off the Vista machine, copy them actually, from the Vista machine to the other machine.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. Yeah. I haven't been able to find that yet.
If you just open two windows, so one window shows your pictures folder and the other window shows the external Toshiba drive, you can just do a select all and drag.
Okay, select all and drag, okay.
That's the easiest way to do it.
And then wait.
Awesome. And then wait.
Yeah, it'd be wild. Not many on there, but a few. One other thing, is there a place where you can take old computers and have it recycled? Like this laptop I'm probably going to get rid of soon. I don't use it anymore, and just get it recycled someplace.
A lot of towns have their own electronic recycling. Check with your town. Check with your garbage company. Sometimes they also do electronic recycling. And probably the big one in town is called E-Waste. They are in Victor at the corner of 96 and 251. And there's a lot of other places around town that will accept drop-offs. I know MicroWorks on Ellens Creek takes drop-offs for e-waste. So depending on where you are, you can go to the e-waste website, and they'll find a drop-off location near you.
Okay, so you can drop it off, and there's no charge for that?
Generally, no. If it's a CRT, then there is a charge. That's about the only thing they charge for.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much, guys.
Yep.
All right, thanks.
And some of the younger people don't know what a CRT is. What did we add up once? Between the three of us, we have over 100 years of computer experience, which is interesting because computers weren't around 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, 100 years ago, a computer was a person who computed.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. We're the old guard, or the old farts, I suppose.
Somebody was mentioning that on one of the podcasts I was listening to.
Before you do that, please give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or text us at 585-209-8887.
So with Apple moving from Intel processors to their own silicon, younger people, mostly kids that have been only programming for a couple of years now, are going to have a much easier transition because they probably are already using Swift, the modern programming environment, and don't have decades of legacy Carbon and Cocoa code that they'll have to convert to the new processor.
Right.
But if you're even older, more longtime programmer, you remember the switch from the Motorola chip to the Intel chip. And we went through this whole thing 20 years ago. And then 20 years before that, we went from the Apple II to the Mac.
Right.
And everything had to get re- So this
from
is
the 6502.
To the 68000. Yeah. And then from the 68000 to the PowerPC, and then PowerPC to Intel, and now Intel to Apple Silicon. So it's our fifth major transition. So if you've been in this for the 40 years we have been,
it's another transition, big deal.
Big deal, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of funny that the younger kids are going to have an easier time of it because they haven't been in it that long.
That's right. When we did it the first time, at least, we had to learn a whole new compiler, whole new languages. If you were one of those people who've been programming in 6502 assembler, you were done.
Yeah.
Well, not to 6800, but to,
that wasn't too bad. Code level. Yeah.
But moving to the PowerPC and then the Intel platform, you were learning a whole new base code structure, which is why people went from that to things like C, which all you had to do was buy a new compiler.
Yeah. I remember when OOPS was the biggest hot new thing.
Oh yeah.
Object oriented programming.
Right. Yeah, I did a lot of Pascal.
Yep.
PL1, Cobalt, Fortran.
Actually, I'm doing a lot of programming in Python right now.
No.
Why not? It runs on everything.
Well, that's the critical thing now. Back in the day, there weren't that many computers to pick from.
Right.
And platforms and different operating systems. And just the different features that are on a computer now. Back when we were first starting out, you were lucky to have a hard drive in it. You usually had 2 5-and-a-quarter floppy drives, a monochrome monitor. You didn't have a mouse.
Yes. My favorite are the snobs. Well, you're programming in Python? That's not a compiled language. I have a 3 gigahertz processor. I have 8 of them. Trust me, it's not going to take that long to interpret. Yeah. I don't care. Oh, and are you programming in PHP? That's a horrible language. A billion websites run on PHP. Yep. Who cares?
There are still, though.
It makes it easy for me to work, and it gets it done.
And
I don't need any more than that.
You're doing it for yourself, not for them.
That's right.
So what's the...
Even when I'm writing code for other people, they don't care. They want the results.
That's all they care about, is the bottom line. As long as they can have a program or whatever come from you, and it does exactly what they want, customer's happy. They don't care what's under the hood.
I wrote some code for a guy who used to take 4 days to compile some information. I did it in PHP so he'd have a web interface, which means you could do it from anywhere at any time. And it took, I think, 38 seconds or something. I forget the exact number, but it was well less than a minute.
Yeah.
He was thrilled. If I had written it in something else, like hand-coded assembler, could I have gotten it faster? Yes. Yep. Why?
Although there still are lots of jobs for COBOL programmers.
Because COBOL will never go out of style.
All of the government mainframes have been running for 40 years. I remember I saw a meme going around. A guy got turned down for a job because it required 5 years' experience in this programming language. He created that programming language 3 years ago.
Java. It was Java. It was John, I can't think of his last name. He created Java, and I got a call from a headhunter, said, I need 5 years' experience in Java. I said, the guy who wrote it didn't write it 5 years ago.
Yeah.
There's no one. I don't know who put your specs together, but they're an idiot.
Yeah. The language was created 3 years ago. No one has 5 years. And the guy that created the language got turned down for the job.
Right. Right. It gets ridiculous. It just gets ridiculous. Snobs, well, this is a much better language. I don't care.
Yeah,
I don't care. I made a lot of money writing it in this language. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm good now. COBOL is still a useful language. And, my students used to ask me, what programming language should I learn? COBOL.
Yeah.
You'll never be a superstar, but you will always have
a
job.
Be in demand. You'll be in demand.
Make it your second language and keep it up to date. There will come a time in your life when somebody's going to say, we will pay you a metric bucket load of cash.
That
to convert
PL1.
Right.
They're so you know, interleaved.
Right, right.
But like you said, if you know COBOL, that's what I first learned was the COBOL, and then picked up the PL1.
Right. Yep.
And it was like, oh, yeah, this just the way it changes some syntax and all that, no big deal.
Right. And I hopped on ZipRecruiter, and COBOL programmers are going for up to $150,000
a year. Yep.
And it can be remote because you're just coding.
Yes.
All right. We've got another question here. It says, looking at downloads, new version, Super Anti-Spyware X from superantispyware.com. And getting message, Super Anti-Spyware can't be downloaded securely from Chrome browser.
Okay, that is possible. If you've blocked cookies and all kinds of other things, then yes, you will get a message like that. But we all try to lock down our browsers, but there are programs that just, there are companies that just don't like that. So, yep. For example, Forbes. I run an anti-ad program, an ad blocker, and I can't get onto the Forbes website. Yep. When I whitelisted them and turned off the ad blocker, mm-hmm. I'm on Forbes with no problem.
And get infected almost immediately.
And probably, well, I only go there on my Chromebook, so do yep. what you want. It's not going to help you any. That certainly is a possibility. They want you to turn off ad blockers and cookie blockers and all of your blockers.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Forbes specifically did have that problem. I think it was last year. There was a malware ad on their website, and you turn off the ad blocker, and you got the ad and got infected immediately.
Yeah, well, I never, I don't run Windows anymore, so yeah. That's not a problem. And I really only go there on my Chromebook.
Your Windows may be infected. Call this phone number.
Yeah. Told you. When you were here, yeah. I got that yeah. on my Chromebook.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That was precious.
That was fun. All you can do, you know, you're on a Chromebook. You just laugh. You just laugh and move on.
But that's the best. Is it?
Oh, someone in the YouTube chat, Smooth Jazz X. All right. That's a nice name. Said Pascal was hard, but Fortran will never go out of style either.
No, you're absolutely right. Smooth Jazz X. I like that a lot. Pascal was very hard. I had the Borland
yep.
Pascal,
yes.
which was one of the first ones available for any sort of home machine. It was hard to learn, absolutely hard to learn.
Well, see, I didn't have any problems with it.
Yeah, no, it was difficult to run because it was a whole thing that you had
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, well, top-down language.
Right. I mean, it was, and basically you could, you know, you would just type the word basic and you were in basic, mm-hmm. but Pascal, yeah. you had to load and do
you
all
had to load
stuff,
your code.
With, which was unusual for many people.
I yeah, load it and then compile it and then run it.
Right.
I remember my COBOL class, we used to have a little competition about how many errors you could generate on your first compile. And I think I won with every single line generated an error because I forgot what the leading semicolon, the
yeah,
first
the
character.
First character.
The
character. Right.
All the way down.
So every single
line.
And that was back in the day where you submitted your job and then they handed you back the paper. When he comes back with a giant stack of fanfold paper.
A friend of mine used to work at the U of R in their computer lab, in their computer science department, the computer center.
Tell me your name.
And I would go and visit him at night because I don't sleep.
Where are you coming from?
And we would be chit-chatting away and people would come up to get their stuff. And you'd hand them the giant yep. stack of paper and then you'd hand them a box with their cards in it. And we had a box of old dead cards,
yep.
and he'd go to hand it to them and fumble it and drop it all over the floor, just to watch people faint.
Well, it probably wouldn't matter too much because if their printout was that thick, something was wrong anyway.
Something was wrong anyway.
That's probably how you ran it, all out of order.
Right. I believe this is Caledonia, and we're talking to Marshall. Yep. Hiya, Marshall. What's up?
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Okay, I volunteer weekly at our local museum, and during the COVID situation, I've been entering new accessions for the museum from home. But there are a couple of things that I can't do from remote that I can do in the office. For example, I can't open a file that ordinarily is a Word document because the version of Word that we have at the museum is something like Word 365, or it's a subscription one.
Right.
So it's not installed on the machine, and the software I want is looking around on the machine for an installed version of that and can't find it. So it tells me, I'm sorry, you can't open this. And a related problem is I also can't activate email because it's looking for an installed email program, and what we use is Gmail.
Right. All right. So there are things you can do to mitigate that. Can you actually get at the Word document, but it will not open?
That's correct.
So if you were to try something like LibreOffice, that may be able to open that document.
If you can't install Word on your computer or don't have the license for it, then you need another program that can read Word files.
Right. And that,
we do have, technically, whatever a license is may be the question here, but we have a subscription to it through a nonprofit organization to use Word in the same way that I use Word on any other PC.
Mac. Then in that case, you should be able to get hold of them and download a copy with a license key to put on your machine. The other thing you could try to do is if they have a VPN, a virtual private network, into the museum's network.
No, we don't.
Okay. Then what you would need to do is get a copy of Office 365
for your home machine. If you don't have a VPN, how are you remotely connecting?
I'm using AnyDesk. Is that a VPN?
It's what?
No. AnyDesk.
I don't know that one.
I don't know AnyDesk, but theoretically...
Oh, it's remote desktop. So you're not running anything on your computer at all. It's a remote desktop. It's as if you're sitting in front of the computer at work. So it doesn't have to open anything on your computer. It's opening it on the other end.
So it should be able to open...
And sending you the screen.
Right. If you're not, if you download the program to your computer and try to open it, you will need the application on your computer. If you try to open it on that computer... inside the AnyDesk window, it should open right on your computer at work.
Well, that's exactly my problem. It doesn't.
What happens when you try? What's the error message?
Let me try it right now.
All right, hold on. We're down to our last minute. This always happens when somebody calls it at the last minute. Do us a favor and write down the error messages that you get, what you tried to do, what error messages you get. Leave a post in soundbites.org and we'll take a look at it.
Okay.
We're sorry. Thanks
for being there.
Yep.
Thank you. Yeah, sorry.
And if it's a nonprofit, they probably don't have an IT staff.
Yeah, into this so much. You know, I mean, I hate doing that to folks, but, you know, it's the same old story. They wait until the last minute. And I can't do anything about it. You know, I hate to shut them off, but it is what it is. So, we were on for 2 hours, folks.
Yeah, when people call it the last minute, it's...
So theoretically, remote desktop is a window on your computer that just looks at the other computer. Everything you're doing is at the other computer. So it's as if you're sitting in front of the other computer. It shouldn't matter that you're on your computer.
And this may be something somebody has to sit with him and look at.
Yeah.
All right, that music tells us we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. Sorry, Marshall. Call in earlier next week. Write down those things. We'll talk to you about it. Put it in the forums, and we'll see what we can do about that. But we are done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. You've been listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's Soundbites. I'm the truly great and truly grateful to you that we can continue with your generous support to be member supported. We will be off for a week, but we will see you next week right here. Same bat time, same bat channel. Be good to one another, will you? We will see you in just 166 hours. Have fun.